Welcome to the Progressive Radio Network. This is Nature Bats Last. It's NBL on PRN.FM. I'm Mike Sleeve along with the good doctor, Guy McPherson. Today is the broadcast premiere of Nature Bats Last, and we would like to thank PRN for its incredible opportunity to share some truth, justice, and perspective about the world we inhabit. We'll try and do our best, and we look forward to the challenge. On today's show, we will cover Gaza and the Big Lie. We'll speak with Ben Pennings, founder of the radical environmental organization Generation Alpha, and how they're dealing with catastrophic coal mining. We'll have a guest commentary on urban water issues in places like Detroit by Forrest Palmer, along with the latest from Guy's Climate Summary and Update, so we can get caught up on what's going on beyond the headlines. Plus, our first Doomer of the Week, and we'll explain that more a little bit later. But first, before we get going, I think we should do a little bit of introduction. Because for all we know, you don't know who we are and why this show is on the air. And so for that, I'll turn it over to my co-host, Dr. Guy McPherson.
Thanks, Mike. It's great to be here with you on PRN. I want to explain how we got started a little bit. I was in New York City in April on a speaking tour, and I did several interviews in the studio at PRN. While I was there, I spoke with PRN's producer about doing a radio show of my own. I thought about it for a long time and finally decided, no. Too much time, too much energy, too much effort are required, and there's no payoff. But then I got to talking about it with my friend and colleague, and now my co-host, Mike Sleva, and I figured it would allow me to spend more time with Mike, which is a good thing, and also spend more time educating myself about a wide variety of topics, which is also a good thing. And here we are.
Here we are. So a little bit about myself. My name is Mike Sleva, and I've somewhat followed in Guy's footsteps by moving towards the exit of empire. My wife and I left our teaching careers in 2011 to pursue a simpler set of living arrangements, and we currently live in a Mongolian ger, which is a yurt, or as we tell our friends, a really nice tent. And our lives for the last 3 years have been pretty much semi-nomadic, and we've lived in a variety of different places in the Southwest and in parts of Europe. I do a little bit of writing from time to time and speaking as well, and now apparently I do a little bit of radio. But enough about us. Why don't we get on with the show? And our first segment that we're going to cover today and what we'd like to do weekly is a little bit of news beyond the mainstream echo chamber. And we understand there's plenty going on in the world, including things like in Gaza and the Ukraine, and jet planes disappearing or being shot from the sky. And this segment, from time to time, will add to those stories, and we hope to go deeper into a lot of other stories as well. In news then, find the root of where our resource wars and water struggles and climate struggles come from. So with that, Let's get to our first headline of the not so mainstream headline news. Guy, what's our first headline of story?
I'm going to talk today from TruthDig, and specifically from a piece written by Chris Hedges at TruthDig called Why Israel Lies. This is from 2 days ago. Chris Hedges was foreign correspondent for the New York Times for many years. He finally couldn't put up with the lies required to hold that job, so he walked away from that. I'm going to just quote a little bit from his article because it gets at a central issue that most Americans, I think, don't hear about from the mainstream media. He points out that, for example, all governments lie, and he says, all of us reporters who have covered the occupied territories have run into Israel's Alice in Wonderland narratives, which we dutifully insert into our stories, required under the rules of American journalism, although we know they are untrue. He goes on to write that the conquest, and it's a conquest, not a war, that's going on in Gaza right now. He writes that the big lie feeds the two reactions Israel seeks to elicit, racism among its supporters and terror among its victims. The bottom line of this story is that I, and I'm quoting here from Chris Hedges, I, along with every other reporter I know who has worked in Gaza, have never seen any evidence that Hamas uses civilians as human shields. This is a big story. It's not being covered by the mainstream media.
Yeah, I think this is a classic case of what Derek Jensen refers to when he talks about hierarchy, and that, I guess, resistance from the bottom of the hierarchy moving up is looked upon as something that is incredibly violent and therefore is met with extreme violence. And when violence at the top of the hierarchy happens, it's looked at as something that is normal, and actually not even violence altogether. It's usually termed self-defense or enforcing policy or a law, or in this case maybe ignoring policy or a law. But it seems to me, I think, there's a group out of Oakland called The Coup, and they wrote a song called The Magic Clap, and they say, when we strike back, it's a magic clap. Like, it's something that's so unusual for those in power that when the hierarchy reacts from the bottom, it's looked at as something really egregious and therefore met with extreme consequences. And I think that's kind of what we're seeing here.
That's right. The dominant paradigm is dominant for a reason. They maintain that iron grip on power, the iron hand, and any resistance is viewed as an incredibly violent and outrageous act.
Absolutely. The story that I wanted to bring about or talk about was actually first found in TomsDispatch.com and later on TruthDig. And I'll cover this pretty quickly. It's called The Original Geoengineers, or How to Save the Iconic West from the Cow, by Chip Ward. And I know Guy talks about this a lot, how the West was lost. And this is another particular instance of the industrial machine and the dominant narrative thinking that we could bend nature to our particular way of life. And it's not happening. And so we put profit and our wants, in this case, beef, in front of what's actually needed for the land. And the consequences are no profit eventually and the destruction of the ecosystems, which we are trying to bend to our, you know, our will. It's a three-page report, and it's classic hubris of the industrial model devouring ecosystems. They talk about two types of people in this conflict: the boomers, which are the people who are profiteers. You're talking like miners, or today probably people who are fracking and looking for a quick turnover, a quick profit, and those people that they call nesters, people kind of moving towards learning from the land and finding out how it works and what it needs and really trying to become more native-like. Today, those people, that fight has really been taken over by conservationists. And it really just points out that, you know, the ranchers are really paranoid of particular elements, in this case particular species, within their ecosystems. They've demonized things like, obviously, the beaver and the wolf. And in this case, the beaver, which has really created the landscape of this country by creating other ecosystems, by moving water into particular areas like meadows, for example, or ponds, and creating ecosystems and food for other species, and thus making the ecosystem much more vibrant, have been moved really outside of this particular ecosystem in the American West and have been moved to higher elevations where they're not doing their jobs of dam building and diverting water and actually slowing water down in some cases so it lasts longer, or filtering it so it's safer. And it's really fear-based, like much of what goes on in this culture. So I encourage you to read it within the July 30th edition of TruthDig, I believe, and the 29th edition of TimesDispatch.com.
Great. So both stories this week from Beyond the Mainstream come from TruthDig. If you haven't read it, I recommend you check it out. We're going to move on now and introduce this week's guest. Mike, why don't you take that?
Well, we're going to have our interview, and we'll give you a little bio on Ben Pennings, and that will be our interview for this particular week.
Ben Pennings is the Australian founder of Generation Alpha at generationalpha.org, an international network of radical activists and deep green thinkers. Generation Alpha has a big picture critique on the possibilities of ecological sustainability and advocates radical strategies for systemic change. Generation Alpha's tagline is honesty, courage, action. And they have just launched a blog to accompany their large social media presence and local groups. Ben, welcome to Nature Bats Last.
Thanks, Guy.
I wanted to really start with your journey and how you came to be an activist and what eventually led to the creation of Generation Alpha. So if you could kind of take us on that path for us.
Well, it's a long one, but yeah, got a little bit of awareness reasonably early in the early teens, and then ended up working for Greenpeace at a pretty young age. I started at 18 for about 3 years, just started knocking on doors and talking to people and raising money and getting involved in actions, and ended up on the Rainbow Warrior 2 for a short while, which was pretty cool as a 20-year-old. Eventually, moved away from that into more social justice sort of type issues, a lot of pro-feminist, anti-violence sort of work and homelessness, and ran for my local council as a Green member, which is very interesting, and many things over the years, and kids and family and the whole lot. But it's been the last couple of years ago, through reading various books and I suppose seeing 20 years or so of the movement not being successful in many ways, that has sort of got me to move in more radical ways, accept more radical thinking, I suppose, and really go for it. I suppose with all my experience over the years, I always knew I'd start something. Never knew what that would be, and Generation Alpha has been it, and it's something that I'm committed to very long term.
Excellent. I mean, the blog itself debuted about a month ago. Is that about right?
Yeah, not very long ago at all.
Okay, and so what's been that process as far as getting people to contribute, and I guess the response from the blog thus far?
Well, it's early days. We started with social media, and we did that for a reason with regards to building up an audience, and also getting some ideas out there, seeing how people respond to various things, and that was more successful than I thought originally. So we've got about 45,000 people around the world on our Facebook site. We're doing a bit of Twitter these days as well. But decided for quite a long time not to have a website. And part of that, we were involved, particularly here in Australia, we were involved in activism where being a little bit unknown was actually useful. So people not knowing who we are, they're new, they put this radical stuff on social media, we don't know how far they'll go or not, and being a little bit less predictable because the companies that often are targeted by environmental groups, really factor what you'll do in and what you won't do.
Right.
So they have their algorithms or whatever it may be to guess how far you'll go, and a lot of groups won't do certain things. So being an unknown quantity was useful for us, but there's always been a plan to get some interesting writers from around the globe to start contributing to the blog, and the response has been great so far. We've definitely got some more out there and controversial things planned, but we're just building it up as we go, so it's all very new and exciting. We're about to launch a big international campaign as well, which will, 2 or 3 weeks, that'll be off the ground, and hopefully everyone will hear about that.
Excellent. So, I mean, there's the blog and there's campaign. So there's really different arms and different facets for Generation Alpha. just besides the writing and the weekly contributors at this point on the blog.
Yeah, we try and be very creative is one thing. So from day one with social media engagement and Facebook posts and things that we write and say, try and be a bit creative, a bit silly. With try and make it fun for what is a pretty serious out there issues that we're looking at as well. So we're trying to engage people that way, and we've done a whole lot of creative direct actions and media stunts over time as well that have got a really good response because of that by the people that we're targeting, as well as mainstream media and the whole lot as well, which has been interesting.
Right. Is there a specific mission or vision you have as far as the the umbrella for the organization itself? What you're really trying to accomplish?
I suppose it's very much trying to radicalize the environment movement. And with regards to the the tactics that people will use, with regards to what their aims are, but also radicalize the movement to a point with regards to having a more systemic analysis of what's been happening for the last couple hundred years, but also what's been happening for the last 10,000 years, I suppose. So it's and recognizing that the environment movement's been going 50 years or so now, and those 50 years have been the most destructive, 50 years where economic growth's gone crazy and capitalism's gone crazy, and things are getting worse rather than better despite our best efforts. So it's accepting that and looking at changing things with regards to how we act, but also what our aims are as well. And I did a very interesting thought experiment a while ago on two of the groups that I've done a lot of time with here over the years. One, which was Greenpeace, as I mentioned, but also the Greens political party here in my state. I actually had a thought experiment and went through all their policies, all their campaigns, and said, well, at the moment, they get 1-5% successful. What about if there was 100% successful? What about if every single thing they wanted to happen happened? And things were obviously, a lot better in the world, but we were still destroying the planet, only a bit slower. So it's recognizing that, all our best aims and intentions are not going to turn things around, they're just going to slow things. So it's looking at more of that systemic analysis, challenging power, challenging privilege, and working on that sort of level, which some of the more radical groups I know in the US are looking at as well.
Great, Ben. This is Guy. You've been speaking to Mike so far. He's been asking the questions. I have a question for you. You keep using the term radical and radicalize. So I'm guessing some of our listeners won't know what you mean by that. Can you explain?
Radical is, with regards to the word, is about roots. It's about going to the root of the problem. So I suppose that's it. So it's not trying to greenwash capitalism. It's not trying to, have shorter showers, as I think Derek Jensen says, and save the world through that. It's actually looking at, what is bigger and harder and more overwhelming but essential to tackle, which is root causes.
Yeah, and I mean, personally, I find one of the things people can do personally to challenge themselves on a radical basis is to look at their privilege. And you mentioned that earlier, and I did read your interview with Shift Magazine, and you said convincing people to give up their privilege is a huge thing. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that and maybe talk about the relationship between privilege and some of the crises you've mentioned.
Yeah, well, I think it was Daniel Quinn quite a long time ago, talked about having people living like pharaohs. So we've got, a couple of billion people on the planet at least living like kings, living like pharaohs in a completely crazy, insane, unsustainable way. And us in the Western world are part of that. And it's not our, fault particularly as individuals, because we've been born into a system of living where, it's ridiculously hard to escape. But I know that you've, tried that, Mike, to a point over the year, but no matter how green, hippie, sustainable we try and go, the way our society is set up, we have an impact. So, that level of privilege is, it's damaging, as we all know. But it's, again, going back to root causes, we're looking at, speciesism, for want of a better word, which is similar to racism, sexism. There's privilege issues there. With speciesism, again, there's privilege. And, me personally, I'm very much of the belief that human exceptionalism is one of the root causes with regards to the damage we're doing to the planet, that humans are somehow better, superior, more worthy of our other species, and we can have this privilege of destroying our own ecosystems and that of others.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, I've through my own, I guess, evolution and breaking through the barriers that I've been set up in front of me through my own education, I've come to realize that I myself, and still many aspects of my life, look at myself as being separate from the land base which supports my life. That being said, I was wondering if you could talk about maybe what people could do on a personal level. I know it's a bit overwhelming when people hear about, you know, these crises and climate change and potential collapse and so on and so forth. And, you know, you think to yourself, well, what can I do to make a difference? And obviously, you know, you're out there doing Generation Alpha and we're talking about these things and you're doing a lot of great things. For the person listening to the show, what are there some things people can do individually that you see as maybe worthy or worthwhile, and that, you know, something they could do, I guess, you know, in their own lives today?
Well, yeah, there's always a lot, and it's unfortunate, I suppose, now that it's, yeah, people see things as irreparable and going down a certain path. There are a lot of people are, you know, giving up to a point or just getting ready for transition or, you know, waiting for collapse sometimes. But I think there is a lot we can do, and we do need to recognize we all have an impact with regards to the planet, but we can also have an impact with regards to, you know, changing how things run, looking at new, you know, ways of living on smaller and larger scales and stopping things. So, you know, despite our best predictions and guesses, we really, you know, the world is a complex place, ecosystems are complex, humans are complex, human societies are complex, and we really can't, you know, predict with any certainty what's going to happen with regards to, you know, how fast climate change will go, or with regards to, you know, resource depletion, with regards to ecosystem destruction, etc. So, yeah, we can have an impact, but we just don't know how, you know, great that will be. And often the best way is to find out what you're good at and do it, but also, you know, be a little bit critical with regards to what's worked in the past, and, you know, do that to modern day scenarios, but also what hasn't worked. So as I mentioned before, is, you know, looking where the movement has been, you know, focused, some of its tactics, some of its aims, and, you know, have small victories here and there, but normally win, lose the battles, and definitely losing the war, if you want to go into that, you know, militaristic sort of terminology. But to be sustainable as an activist, you've got to, you know, look after yourself, but also, you know, do something you enjoy, either using the talents you've got or talents you want to learn, and shop around, find a group that's going to, you know, it's going to suit your talents and personality, and get involved. As I mentioned, with regards to, you know, humans have privilege, but there's also many subsets of humans have privilege. And if you are particularly economically privileged, but, you know, like myself, a sort of educated, white, heterosexual, able-bodied male, etc., if I'm not going to do it, who is? So for me, I feel a huge sense of responsibility of having the privilege that I've got and having some of the knowledge that I've got to work as hard as I can to use that, and have support of a, you know, wonderful family, which is really important as well. To, you know, having a stable, loving family life is really beneficial for what I do. And going back to those values at the start we mentioned of, you know, being honest, being brave, and acting. And it's hard to do. Like, the honesty for a start, people, you know, some of the work that Guy does as an example, and many others, you look into that sort of stuff, and it's really hard not to feel despair and feel overwhelmed. And yeah, I've definitely been through that and know many people that have. But, you know, it's a matter of getting support and coming out through the other end, and, you know, losing a little bit of the ego, for want of a better word, and saying, well, yeah, despite this information I've got, we never do know. The world is a complex place. You know, it's better to have an impact than not have an impact, and, you know, have faith in the universe that, you know, things will turn out.
Absolutely. I mean, you mentioned several times the complexity of the situations we face, and the complexities of our own lives. And and throwing yourself in there, being an activist, and then creating something like Generation Alpha, and really using a military term again, you know, going into the battle. I was wondering if you could talk about so far some of the challenges your organization has faced, and some of the things you've had to think about as moving forward.
Well, there's always challenges, whether that's, you know, personal or systemic. Like, you know, we've sort of set up all this stuff on social media, and Facebook has died pretty badly with regards to encouraging organizations to spend lots of money rather than getting, you know, doing work for free, which is difficult to reach an audience. And one of the reasons we've moved over to the generationalpha.org and getting people to transfer over there. But we're about to start and be involved in a what should be a pretty large-scale direct action campaign, based against the biggest proposed coal complex in the world here in the state that I live in Queensland, Australia. And this is, for American listeners, it's, climate change-wise, it's the same as the tar sands. Okay. So looking at, it's only a number, but, 700 million tonnes or so of carbon a year, huge ecosystem destruction, threatening the Great Barrier Reef here, one of the seven wonders of the world. It's all pretty crazy stuff. And we've got conservative governments here, but the less conservative governments are pretty similar. We've got the G20s coming to the city that I live in later in the year, and there's been a lot of laws enacted with regards to that. So it's talking about the things we're doing and planning is more dangerous. And that's got to involve decisions with friends and family. And so there's that government intervention is a real issue. We've had sort of corporate intervention, corporate spies here. It's some blockades and other things going on here as well. And, activists going to court over some interesting things recently. So, that's a challenge. As always, personal challenges of maintaining your own, personal well-being to be able to sustain this sort of work and, keep food on the table and all that sort of stuff. It's
absolutely.
Also, keeping groups going, like working with groups and caring for each other. And it's always a difficult, whether that group's got an environmental agenda or a corporate agenda. It never runs 100% smoothly, and you've really got to give each other time and space and trust and work as well you can and keep the eye on the prize, I suppose, is sort of keep your aim and work hard. And really, again, that level of criticism for me is really important, is that is this something we've done before? Are we just trying to put a nice little greenwash to something?
Right.
Divestment is a really big thing recently, and I'm quite concerned and to a point critical about divestment being a major strategy of the climate movement. I know I'm not the only one. I know there's many in the US, and I know Tim DeChristopher is one, has been pretty critical with regards to where the climate movement's going, looking where the money comes from. So, groups that have got a high level of corporate funding, who those corporates are, what they can and can't say, maybe not through explicit means, but with regards to, self-censorship as well, which is pretty common when you've got some corporate money behind you. So it's not always a good thing that the environment movement is professionalized, and that I'm really very big on grassroots, volunteer-run groups coming to the forefront of the movement.
I mean, so as an activist, and you've been in this game for quite a while, and from what you've said, obviously, as things get worse, my words, that is activism changing, and is it changing dramatically as we come to these tipping points and situations like the pipeline, for example?
Well, things, as we know, will get worse because we've set it and trained and done the damage already with regards to climate change and some other issues. It's very easy to imagine that the movements will radicalize when things get more desperate, because there is, a core there of people who, love ecosystems, love their land base, love their own species, love other species, and that will, that will come out. That's going to depend on the responses to that, and, there's millions of variables. But if things get worse, particularly with regards to climate change, very quickly, then who knows? People could be moving more into a survival mode and preparing, and yeah, it's really hard to tell. But as far as I'm concerned, I don't know how bad things are going to get and how quickly. And even if some of the worst case scenarios were true, what the hell else am I going to do with my life? I've got no interest in, you know, 9 to 5, you know, working for money as much as need to. My interest is in, you know, helping working to, you know, make a better world for, you know, all species as much as I can in my own way, and involving other people with that. So yeah, it's all I want to do is that and look after my family. So, which means I haven't got much of a social life these days, but that's all right.
Could be worse. You could be living in a tent.
Yes. Well, actually, I'd like more of that. And that's what's interesting. That's something which is happening in, you know, I'm 42 and my, you know, little midlife crisis, for want of a better word, is just getting desperately wanting to escape the city and the internet.
Right.
It's been very interesting. So I've been out there, you know, went and changed the family Tarraga. We've got 4 kids between us to, you know, a car that will go a bit, you know, deeper into the bush and that may have some damage, which is an interesting personal choice to make as well. But just wanting to, you know, get away for a week or so at a time, away from everything, show the kids what, you know, more about the natural world is, and, you know, let them have that sort of experience as well. And that's been my personal thing lately, is just to get away from ubiquitous of major, you know, culture, the internet, always, you know, things always happening. So it's
right.
Yeah, but I suppose it's better than having a sports car and an affair and such things.
Absolutely. I mean, it's tough because, you know, the dominant culture is everywhere, and, you know, where I live, it's pretty rural, but, you know, the few children that I come across in my daily life, they're trapped by the same things we are. You know, they're either their faces in a Game Boy, or they're online as much as I am. And it's one of those things that I try and balance as well. I've told myself over and over again, this is going to be the last computer I ever buy. But at the same time, it's the only way I can connect with what's going on for a larger picture. And so I struggle with that as well, and trying to balance my time, in cyber world and in the actual the world that supports my life. So I feel you is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, and we can be using computers and going on holidays and doing, you know, escaping, doing all sorts of things for, you know, usual purposes, but it's all part of a wider, yeah, life aim to make be involved in the environment movement, do good things, help others, work for your land base, the whole lot. So I'm not the sort of person who, you know, beat myself up about some personal choices, because I know where my heart and mind and motivation are, and honest with myself about that. But also know that I could, it's a bit of a balance with regards to your time. I could spend a huge, you know, more proportion of my time, you know, working on personal choices. So spending more time shopping at all sorts of other, you know, places, walking more places, doing all sorts of things which I know are slightly better than what I do, but also know without that I'm still having an impact and things aren't changing on this systemic level. And, you know, when I'm looking at the the coal mining complex proposed up here in the Galilee Basin, which is, yeah, we're the biggest proposed one in the world, you know, a mine that's got approved by our federal government here a couple of days ago, which will be the biggest coal mine in the Southern Hemisphere. It's, you know, 40 kilometers across for one coal mine. It's just insane. And you look at the numbers, the amount of water it's going to be using, the ecosystems involved, and knowing that it's completely unnecessary. You know, even for our current level of consumption, lifestyle, electricity usage, it's still completely unnecessary. But because some, you know, billionaires have, you know, spent lots of money on mining leases and they want to get their, you know, get their money back before coal completely dies, it's this last desperate, same with the tar sands. It's horrible, insane stuff, and we've got to call it that, and we've got to, you know, for want of using a better term, the line in the sand somewhere. And I'm glad there is some more, you know, radical groups here in the US and Europe, etc., really, you know, talking that way. And it's about stopping things. It's not about delaying things. It's not about putting them off and hoping. It's really, powerful, we will stop you. And yeah, our campaign we started with that was called Over Our Dead Bodies, and we're quite, you know, serious about that.
Yeah.
We're just about to change the name and yeah, involving a lot more other groups, and you know, I can't really say too much obviously, but we will be over talking to you guys in the US as well, because it is just as important as stopping the tar sands, and it's actually much easier to stop this in the tar sands because it's hasn't gone as far yet, and the economics are more marginal, and there's a lot we can do. So we'll be, you know, focused on that, as well as, you know, our GenerationAlpha.org website with regards to getting different, you know, ideas out there to, you know, challenge where people are at and excite them about doing different things with their lives.
Great. Ben, this is Guy again. You mentioned your group or your movement is called Over Our Dead Bodies, or has that phrase. Now, I hear all the time that tone of language like that is just going to turn people off.
Generation Alpha is very much about not preaching to the choir, but teaching the choir to sing better. There's so many people involved, you know, with the environment movement and the fringes around the world, hundreds of millions. But, and those people can be used to do really, you know, important, exciting, and you know, impactful work, but it's not happening enough. So, yeah, that's our aim, is to involve people already engaged and having some of the concerns and values that we've got to, you know, get them to look in a systemic way and to act in a way which is challenging, you know, and undermining a dominant, you know, culture and systems of living, rather than, you know, trying to modify it in small ways. So that's where we're at, and we're happy for other groups to, you know, do some of that mainstream mass education, which, you know, takes generations to work as far as we know. But yeah, a lot of us will believe we haven't got those generations to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And coming from, I guess, you know, the mainstream not too long ago myself, and I think it would do people, cliche, a world of good if you just take a step outside of your comfort zone, and maybe even one step beyond that. And once I started to do that, I actually could see the psychosis is what I refer to it in the dominant culture. It's literally a psychosis, and it's this want for more, and really confusing your needs. They're no longer your needs, they're your wants, which eventually you think become your needs. But I appreciate organizations such as Generation Alpha for doing the work that other groups really, you know, aren't built to do and don't have the fortitude to do and don't have the stomach for. I was happy to contribute a piece and very honored to be part of a group of people who are, I think, are doing, well, really the work of our lives. So I thank you for that. Is there anything else you'd like to add as far as yourself or Generation Alpha before we call it a day?
No, not much particularly. Obviously, we'd encourage people to visit the new blog at generationalpha.org. From there, you'll be able to hear about the new international campaign coming up with the Galilee Basin, and we're particularly keen that folk in the US get to know about that. And there is some of the US groups, you know, doing a little bit of work on it already because of its size and, you know, international impact with regards to climate change in particular. But yeah, don't get us wrong, we're into groups of all types and people need to go where we're at, but we're, you know, we believe that the grassroots and more radical movement needs to grow and strengthen and drag everyone with us. And that's how things have changed over time in many movements. It is the more, you know, brave, radical out there folk of, yeah, really pushed the boundaries, pushed the envelope and, you know, got people to move their way over time. The real big factor with regards to what we're dealing with now with climate change and, you know, ecosystem destruction and resource depletion is time. Time is the really big crucial factor. So yeah, thinking, yeah, I'll think about this in 10 years, or I'll, you know, do some more of my career first, or I'll do this or do that, you know, may not be an option for people who want to get involved. So yeah, it's about being honest about that and having the, you know, courage to act on your convictions and beliefs and values, and, you know, find other people doing it. And that's a good thing that I've seen with Generation Alpha and similar groups, is that you realize that you're not alone. You're not the only one who thinks, you know, things are a bit insane. You're not the only one who, you know, despairs about the state of the world and the level of destruction and the, you know, level of inaction. There's many out there who, have the same thoughts and feelings, and you know, we're about connecting those people and, you know, working together to, you know, for our own benefit and for, you know, above and beyond.
Well, thank you. This has been Ben Pennings, Australian founder of Generation Alpha and activist. You can see his work and others' work at generationalpha.org. Thanks, Ben, for being on Nature Bats Last, and we look forward to catching up with you down the road.
Cool. Thanks, Mike. Thanks, Guy.
In a culture full of hope in the forms of technology, wishful thinking, or a great awakening by the industrial power structure, or maybe even awakening, quite frankly, from ourselves, in what Derek Jensen calls a culture of make-believe, some important voices are speaking truth to power. Each week we'll have a brief opinion piece. In this segment, we hear from radical perspectives that cut to the root of an issue and expose some truth that has been widely hid, ignored, or filed under the oblivious for the general populace. This week, we have two contributors. We begin with Lindsay Morrison, and here is this week's Breaking Hopium.
Why would I want to break hopium in the first place? It sounds sort of mean. I hear people say, you know, we're just simple country people. We never pulled the strings of power. We did the best we could to become what we were taught. And if the world can't be saved, why deprive us of our last crumbs of hopium? But the way I see it, it's a simple matter of safety. When hopium runs out, you get hysteria. And history shows what happens when people don't know why the crops fail. They turn up the prejudice and they form mobs. Hopium prevents an honest conversation. It pumps out noisy distractions and irrelevant tantrums, and it's deeply rooted in some core faith that somehow, somewhere, a reasonable panel of experts are keeping track of the world and would alert you if there was a problem. And that's why I intend to break hopium in places it's never been broken before.
This is Breaking Hopium with Forrest.
The thought of the day is concerning the water situation in the city of Detroit as a harbinger of things to come for all of us. By all of us, I mean all of humanity. The insulating properties of Western imperialism that has diverted all the resources of the earth towards this corner of the world reached its zenith a long time ago. Currently, the last futile attempts to keep it going a few more years, or even nanoseconds for that matter, has commenced in Western societies, with the most maniacal schemes being dispensed by the United States. In the case of Detroit, over the past few weeks, the city has cut off the water services to 15,000 people, and it could potentially affect 300,000 residents. Now, at the present time, the issue of getting the water to the residents is one of just having them pay an exorbitant amount to the city in order to direct this particular resource to their homes. As issues have continuously become worse financially in the city regarding employment due to a still eroding manufacturing automotive base and its surrounding tax revenue as a result, everyday life is becoming haywire in the Motor City. According to Huffington Post, although the unofficial unemployment rate is 15%, the real unemployment rate is over 50%. And even with this current plight of the average citizen in a veritable economic hell of not knowing where his or her next meal is coming from amid basic survival in the concrete jungle, the state compounds the issue by increasing the payment rate for water usage by 8.7% in June of 2014. And even with all these machinations to increase the influx of revenue, the Detroit Water and Sewage Department is $5 billion in debt as of June 2014. This doesn't bode well for the future when the municipal department is trying to tread water with the debt it has now. However, the problem runs much deeper than any of this, since the increase in the payment rate for water and the ongoing debate about the need to privatize the water system to make it solvent mask a much bigger issue. These are all things being done under the presumption that the automotive industry will come back. The factories will open again, and people will be back working in the proverbial good old days. Keep dreaming. See, the auto industry isn't coming back with or without influx of loans from the government, and whether or not any American imbecile thinks that Barry, my pet name for President Obama, is turning this place into the Soviet Union of old under his administration. To pull yourself up by your bootstrap Horatio Alger narrative of Lee Iacocca, son of Italian immigrants, going to the Motor City and saving a company like Chrysler won't be happening again. The abundance of resources, primarily oil, that allowed the American manufacturing base to be built upon a belief that two-ton automobiles could be built in perpetuity is proven to be a pipe dream devised of a people and society that has made continuous growth synonymous with a laughable belief in American exceptionalism. Therefore, we are beyond trying to pay a measly water bill to solve this problem. as water is a need and not a want, the reintroduction of the commons as a real thing in this world will also coincide with a decrease in our living standard that has been deemed sacrosanct. At the end of the 16th century, Queen Elizabeth I of England said that she took a bath every month whether she had to or not. Although this seems insane and sadly laughable to most people in the Western world, she was living to the ability that the resource base allowed her to live at that particular moment. This country has been living on borrowed time, and we will have no choice but to learn to live within our limits as things decrease exponentially over the next few years. No one is assured of what this will be currently, but it won't entail something as simple as paying your water bill on time to guarantee you have water coming out of the tap. Those days are dead and will never return. This is a conversation we need to be having now, and we will be having it, whether we want to or not.
All right. Lindsay Morrison is a journalist I was fortunate to meet in New York State in April. She's an excellent writer, and we thank her for her excellent introduction to this recurring statement that will be you'll hear from each week. Her voice was followed by that of Forrest Palmer from Houston, Texas. We'll be hearing from one or both of them each week. We'll also be hearing from somebody else, usually a different voice each week, in a segment we call Doomer of the Week. And here's that segment for our first Doomer of the Week.
This is our Doomer of the Week segment. This week's Doomer of the Week is Florence Windfall from the west coast of the United States. Florence writes on Facebook, "The Earth doesn't necessarily have all the time in the world to recover, like many people think. The Earth is on the very edge of the Goldilocks zone and will cross over it in only some millions of years, making it too hot for life on Earth, like Venus. It doesn't have another billion years to live at all. It's more than two-thirds, perhaps three-fourths of its way through its lifespan. The Earth is said to be a fragile old lady. The Earth had devised a way of cooling itself in spite of the sun getting hotter and hotter through the eons because it's burning out on its own way through its own lifespan. The Earth had a way of cooling itself with ice ages and had created many temperate zones. But now that we've ruined all that, it will have trouble cooling down again sufficiently to host life, because it's facing more and more heat all the time. The sun's expansion with old age as it burns out, and the Earth moving out of its privileged Goldilocks zone. Hopium about life magically recovering and even going on forever is hopium. The Hopiates can cultivate their hopium and smoke it." Thanks for that tidbit. Florence Windfall from the west coast of the United States with this week's moment of doom here on Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM.
Excellent. So each week we'll have a Doomer of the Week, and those doomers listening out there, maybe that's some sort of goal for yourself, but Guy and I generally scour social media sites, do a lot of reading, and decide usually a day or so before who our Doomer of the Week is going to be, and so hopefully we'll hear from you. Finally, the last part of our show, what we'd like to do is generally update people on Guy's climate change summary and update from his blog, which is updated constantly and is probably the most read segment on his blog because it is constantly changing. And so we go to the good doctor for our climate summary update.
Thanks, Mike. Generally, I'll provide just information from the previous week, but since this is the premiere show, I can go back to the last 18 months, right?
Yeah.
Well, okay, I'll go back at least the last 10 days. First up, dire news published in the July 25th, 2014 issue of Science regarding synchronization of the warming in the North Pacific and North Atlantic oceans. And this is a quote. "The study found that synchronization of the two regional systems began as climate was gradually warming. After synchronization, the researchers detected wild variability that amplified the changes and accelerated into an abrupt warming event of several degrees within a decade," end quote. Global average temperature rising, quote, several degrees within a few decades, end quote, seems problematic to me and to anybody else with a biological bent. As reported 8 days later in the journal Nature Climate Change, rapid warming of the Atlantic Ocean, likely caused by global warming, has turbocharged Pacific equatorial trade winds. Currently, the winds are at a level never before seen on observed records, which extend back to the 1860s. When this phenomenon ceases, Likely rapid changes will include a sudden acceleration of global average surface temperatures. So there we have a couple of very significant pieces of evidence that have been presented within the last few days in two of the premier journals with respect to science in the world. But that's not all. We have further confirmation the clathrate gun had been fired, which came from Stockholm University's Orjan Gustafsson, who reported from the Laptev Sea on July 23, 2014. Quote, results of preliminary analyses of seawater samples pointed towards levels of dissolved methane 10 to 50 times higher than background levels, end quote. Jason Box, well-known climatologist who works primarily on Greenland ice, responds to the news in the conservative fashion I've come to expect from academic scientists. In his case, 4 days later, July 27, 2014. Quote, what's the take-home message, if you ask me? Because elevated atmospheric carbon from fossil fuel burning is the trigger mechanism poking the climate dragon. The trajectory we're on is to awaken a runaway climate heating that will ravage global agricultural systems, leading to mass famine, conflict. Sea level rise will be a small problem by comparison, end quote. 4 days later, during an interview with Vice, published on August 1, 2014, Box loosened up a bit, saying, quote, even if a small fraction of the Arctic carbon were released to the atmosphere, and I can't say the next word on the air, but it starts with an F and rhymes with truck.
Beep.
Trust me, Jason, we're already there. We've been releasing carbon into the atmosphere, and not just a small fraction, for quite a while. Moving on, simultaneously with this Laptev Sea mission conducted by the University of Stockholm folks, several large holes were discovered in Siberia, and you've probably read about these if you haven't been living in a cave for the last week or so. The initial reaction from the Referee Journal literature, a paper published the 31st of July, 2014 in Nature, indicates atmospheric methane levels more than 50,000 times the usual. That's a big number. An article in the August 4th, 2014 issue of Truthout ponders the holes and concludes, quote, if you have ever wondered whether you might see the end of the world as we know it in your lifetime, you probably should not read this story, nor study the graphs, nor look at the pictures of methane blowholes, a.k.a. dragon burps. All this information points toward a topic we cover here at NBL on PRN, near-term human extinction. You won't find this topic covered by anybody else in the media, but for us, it's a staple. Spend every Tuesday night with us for discussions about the most important topics facing humanity.
Oh, great. And that's the good news. So those are the segments that we have. What we'd like people to do, and because we've been asked on various places whether or not we will take callers, and eventually we may down the road once we figure out what the heck we're doing. But we would like to start at least by taking questions that are post on our Facebook pages and so forth. So if you'd like to post questions that we could ask either guests or we could answer ourselves, that would be a great interactive way to become part of the show. And, hey, it may even get you a Doomer of the Week. So make sure to like our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last and the Progressive Radio Network, and join our group, Nature Bats Last, on PRN.fm. And make sure you post those questions. And please continue to follow Guy's blog, Nature Bats Last, for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. And finally, if you're finding yourself in need of support in dealing with these heavy issues, please find the Near-Term Human Extinction page on Facebook and join the conversation. There's plenty of people out there who may be going through similar emotion roller coaster as you and can help provide some personal insight to these, well, monumental issues. So we hope to see you every Tuesday evening at 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time. And if you miss us, make sure to find us on the archives at PRN.fm and rate us on iTunes. And before we go, back to Dr. Guy McPherson.
Thanks, Mike. You mentioned the Near-Term Human Extinction Support Group on Facebook. This is a group of people who are very interested in discussing the issue of human extinction in the near term and who, contrary to what I read in the in my email inbox. These are folks who actually are benefiting from discussions about the most dire news we could possibly receive as a species. And so I'm going to quote from a recent post at the Near Term Human Extinction Support Group. Feel free to join that group, and I think you'll find it a very welcoming, supportive place. Here's a paragraph written there from within the last week. I've been at home since before I got the full message about near-term human extinction, not going into town at all due to various circumstances. I've seen a friend or two at my house, but other than that, I've been away from other humans for about 2 months. Went into the bank today to get a form notarized and mailed. I found myself being much more gentle and kind to everyone, making more eye contact, not putting up walls. I was thinking, I hope it goes well for you. I hope it's not too difficult. That sort of thing. I seem to have more compassion for others since understanding what we were facing. And each interaction felt precious. It was surprising. And that post from a little less than a week ago at the Near Term Human Extinction Support Group on Facebook, elicited a number of responses that were in agreement, that were providing affirmation that that's the kind of thing I'm feeling too, was the general response. And so you don't have to take this news and run for your lives. You don't have to take this news and enter a period of horrible depression. You might go there. You might be terribly depressed. But I'm suggesting that you need not spend the rest of your life there, that in fact, with this news in mind, you might enjoy life in its moments just a little bit more than you otherwise would have.
Some sound advice. It's an excellent group, and I've just recently joined it myself. Well, that about does it for our premiere broadcast, and we've had a lot of fun this week. Remember to join us next Tuesday evening if you can, and if you can't, find us in the archives, and again, please rate us on iTunes. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
nature bats last. Thanks for joining us here on PRN.
Good night.
Mother Nature.